The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Associated Press, Religion News Service, and U.S. News and World Report. Our first article was published by the Associated Press on December 26 and written by Maria Sherman, entitled, "The Rapper Ye, who has a long history of making anti-Semitic comments, issues an apology in Hebrew." The rapper formerly known as Kanye West, who has a long history of making anti-Semitic comments, apologized to the Jewish community in an Instagram post written in Hebrew on Tuesday. "I sincerely apologize to the Jewish community for any unintended outburst caused by my words or actions," Ye wrote. "It was not my intention to offend or demean, and I deeply regret any pain I may have caused," continued the rapper, who legally changed his name to Ye in 2021. The statement arrives less than 2 weeks after Ye went on an anti-Semitic rant in Las Vegas while promoting his upcoming album Vultures, due out January 12. In the rant, he made insidious insinuations about Jewish influence and compared himself to Jesus Christ and Adolf Hitler. After causing untold damage by using his vast influence and platform to poison countless minds with vicious anti-Semitism and hate, an apology in Hebrew may be the first step on a long journey toward making amends to the Jewish community and all those who he hurt, the Anti-Defamation League said in a statement to the Associated Press. "Ultimately, actions will speak louder than words, but this initial act of contrition is welcome." The American Jewish Committee, however, criticized Ye's use of Hebrew in the apology. "Beyond being bizarre and possibly a ploy to gain more attention, the Hebrew apology, posted without translation, is inaccessible to most American Jews who do not speak the language," the AJC said in a statement to the AP. "To be sure, using Hebrew to communicate with the Jewish community intentionally denies most American Jews, and consequently non-Jews, the ability to directly see Kanye's apology. While he claims that he is committed to learning and greater understanding, this apology speaks to any pain I may have caused, rather than acknowledging the pain that he has caused," the AJC continued. Ye has a history of offensive and anti-Semitic comments, including repeated praise of Hitler and the Nazis. He also once suggested slavery was a choice and called the coronavirus vaccine the mark of the beast. In October 2022, he was criticized for wearing a White Lives Matter t-shirt at his Paris Fashion Week show and tweeted that he was going to go DEFCON 3 on Jewish people, an apparent reference to the U.S. Defense Readiness Condition Scale, DEFCON. Later that month, the Balenciaga fashion house cut ties with Ye, and he lost the lucrative partnership with Adidas that had helped to catapult him to billionaire status over his remarks. "Ye's recent comments and actions have been unacceptable, hateful, and dangerous, and they violate the company's values of diversity and inclusion, mutual respect and fairness," the German sportswear company said at the time. Adidas has sold hundreds of millions of euros in remaining Yeezy shoes, donating part of the profits to groups like the Anti-Defamation League and the Philonese and Keita Floyd Institute for Social Change. Recently, though, Adidas CEO Boyan Gulden said on a podcast episode that he didn't think Ye meant what he said, and I don't think he's a bad person. Gulden later apologized, the Anti-Defamation League said. Ye was also dropped by talent agency CAA, and his documentary with MRC Entertainment was scrapped. He was locked out of his accounts on Instagram and what was then known as Twitter, though he has since returned to both platforms. This isn't the first time the rapper has apologized for his anti-Semitic comments. He expressed some remorse for his DEF CON 3 tweet on a podcast in October 2022, characterizing the initial tweet as a mistake and apologizing to the Jewish community. He also went on Piers Morgan Uncensored. "I will say I'm sorry for the people that I hurt with the confusion that I caused," he said on the show. But less than 2 months later, he told conspiracy theorist and host Alex Jones that he sees good things about Hitler. "We've seen this behavior from Kanye before, the anti-Semitic rant and the follow-up apology," the American Jewish Committee said. Ye's latest apology ends with him saying he's committed to learning from his experience and plans on making amends. A representative for Ye did not immediately respond to AP's request for further comment. Now an article published by the Associated Press on December 21, written by Giovanni Del Orto, entitled, "Faith groups say more foster families are needed to care for the children coming to the U.S. alone." Homestead, Florida. Snuggling on the sofa across from the Christmas tree, Sol proudly showed off the dog her foster parents gave her for earning all A's, even though she crossed the southern U.S. border knowing very little English. "They helped me a lot," said the 14-year-old eighth grader. Then she blushed, hid her face in Cosmo's fur, and added in Spanish, "Oh, I said that in English." Sol, who is from Argentina, is among tens of thousands of children who arrive in the U.S. without a parent. During a huge surge in immigrants that's prompting congressional debate to change asylum laws, faith and community groups across the country are trying to recruit many more foster families to help move the children from overwhelmed government facilities. U.S. authorities encountered nearly 140,000 unaccompanied minors at the border with Mexico in fiscal year 2023, according to U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Almost 10,000 are still in custody of the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Refugee Resettlement, according to the latest data. "It's amazing the quantity of children who are coming," said Monica Farias, who leads the Unaccompanied Refugee Minors Program for Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Miami. "We're actively recruiting parents." Program leaders have been going to churches and other community organizations every weekend to find more families like Andy and Caroline Hazelton, Sol's foster parents. Over the past 4 years, the Hazeltons, a couple in their early 30s living in a Miami suburb with three biological daughters, ages 8, 6, and almost 2, have fostered five migrant minors for several months, and many for shorter periods. Two teens were from Afghanistan, but most came from Central America. "Our faith inspired us," Andy Hazelton said, adding they felt the need to respond to the gospel exhortation of helping others as one would help Jesus when they heard about families being separated at the border. Like other foster families, the Hazeltons say they focus not on the often stridently divisive politics of immigration, but simply on assisting children in need. A globe ornament on their living room Christmas tree is marked with dots for the birthplaces of each family member. "Every Christmas, we have new kids in our home," Caroline Hazelton said, adding that even the Muslim Afghan teens who had never seen a stocking bulging with presents quickly joined the festivities. Like most youths in these programs, those boys were eventually reunited with their birth family. The mother hugged Caroline for 10 minutes, sobbing in gratefulness. With Sol, whose father has gone missing on the journey across the desert, and other children without relatives in the U.S., foster families' commitments can last for years. As Sol packed her school lunch in a Stranger Things bag under Cosmo's watchful eye, the Hazeltons said they would be happy to have her stay forever, and already refer to their four daughters. Regardless of the length of stay, foster parents say they need to give the children enough stability to get comfortable with unfamiliar U.S. customs, from air conditioning to strict school routines, and to learn more English. We're never going to be like their parents. Thank God we live in a country where things can be easier, said Carlos Zubazaretti. A foster child himself 50 years ago, he's been a foster parent in the Miami area for about 30 children over nearly two decades, in addition to having biological, now adult children. Nevertheless, he always finds it hard when each foster child leaves after they've shared nightly dinners, vacations, and household tasks like car maintenance. Zubazaretti plans to continue to foster as long as he feels that is what God is calling him to do. In Baltimore, Jason Herring has been a foster father for a year to five children from Central America through a program run by Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service that focuses on short-term care for those whose return to biological parents is being assessed by the government. He says he is not religious. Initially, he feared he wouldn't be accepted in the program for being gay. That led him to sympathize with the plight of children suffering because of adult decisions they have no power over. I understand what it feels like to be the other, he said. You don't have to be a perfect parent. Just be there. Like all foster families, those taking in unaccompanied migrant children must be licensed by their state and often receive extra training specific to immigration law and trauma, said Amanda Nozell, the Lutheran agency's program manager for foster care in Baltimore. There's certainly a national shortage in foster parents right now. We have so many kids who need homes, Nozell said. Acclimating to a new country in a caring family setting is especially important given the deep and increasing level of trauma these children carry, from what they had to flee in their countries through the journey to the U.S. It's trauma on top of trauma on top of trauma. Kids are just living in survival mode, said Sarah Howell, a clinical social worker in Houston, with long experience counseling migrant children, including a teenage girl she's raising. They often internalize fear and grieving so much that they appear mature beyond their age, while still being terrified that any new familial relationship will abandon them. It takes a while before foster parents are relieved to see regular child or teen behavior make an appearance, even if that means refusing all but junk food or sibling bickering. It's still a sign of normalcy. All of them are kids, but with an adult age, said Bernie Villar, who works as a mentor in a home for vulnerable youth, including those who age out of Miami's Catholic Charities foster care. Villar, 24, was homeless when he was younger, and he tries to pass on the passion for education that helped him survive. But he says many are too burdened by the debts they owe the smugglers who brought them to the U.S. to be interested in anything but work, while others struggle with depression after witnessing death and violence on their journeys. Brandon Garcia, 20, seems to have beaten the odds. After crossing alone at 15, because his parents told him he would have no opportunities in Guatemala's indigenous highlands, he spent 6 months living with the Hazeltons and is now in Villar's group home, finishing technical college. He still misses his family, but loves the Hazeltons' daughters as his sisters. At a holiday party in a suburban Miami bowling alley organized by the Catholic Charities program, He played with them at intervals between bites of pizza and aiming for strikes with other young men. Garcia said the speed of change as he adapted to the U.S. was hard, but he has never thought of going back. His happiest moment came when the Hazeltons brought him to Orlando's theme parks, a holiday tradition that they plan to continue this year with Soul, and they watched the fireworks display. I felt the same happiness as with my family, Garcia said. I told myself, this is a country of great opportunities, and I have to take advantage of them. Now an article published by the Associated Press on December 22 and written by Steve LeBlanc, entitled, At a Church Rectory in Boston, Haitian Migrants Place Their Hopes on Hard Work and Helping Hands. Boston. When Ernzo Admetra decided to leave Haiti and head north with his young family in tow, very little was guaranteed. But the situation in his homeland, beset by poverty and gang violence, had grown so dire that a risky passage to and then across the U.S. southern border offered a kind of hope he said he could never find by staying put. Admetra discovered Boston through the internet and set his sights on Massachusetts, and the trip took the family through several countries, including the Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, and Mexico. We're going through a very tragic moment in our country. We have no safety. We cannot definitely have all our needs met in Haiti, Admetra said through a translator. Leaving Haiti was the best solution to survive. The Admetras, Ernso, 43, his wife Jimena, 36, and their children Eleone, 6, and Gabiana, 2 months, eventually arrived at the Boston International Airport, right as winter temperatures were setting in. Ernso Admetra said he was lucky to be discovered by volunteers working to fill gaps in the shelter system as his family was being kicked out of the airport. He viewed those volunteers as angels sent by God. I don't have any family who lives in the U.S., he said. We didn't expect to receive this welcome or experience because we have no family ties here. The family is now one of eight that have found shelter at a rectory building at the Bethel AME Church in Boston's Jamaica Plain neighborhood. The families, which include 13 children ranging from infants to a 15-year-old, total 28 individuals, according to Gerald Gabeau, executive director of the Immigrant Family Services Institute in Boston, which is helping provide services. Admetra said he has received a work authorization and hopes to start bringing in money so his family can move out of the shelter and into an apartment. He said he has studied business administration and computer sciences and is also a tailor. Gabeau said the migrants are determined to work hard to find their way in the country. She said they are focused first on getting authorized to work. The organization hopes to bring in employers in January to help those living in the rectory find a way to a job and a more permanent home. For now, they live and cook together and take English and computer classes. They live as a community, Gabeau said, pointing to big pots of vegetables and meat and Haitian rice on the kitchen stove. Demand for shelter has increased as the state struggles to find newly arriving migrants places to stay after hitting a state-imposed limit of 7,500 families in its emergency homeless shelter system last month. As of Thursday, there were more than 350 families on the state wait list, hoping to find a spot in the system. The state planned to open a former courthouse in Cambridge on Friday as an overnight overflow site to accommodate some of them. The space can fit up to 70 families with cots and limited amenities and will only be used in the evening and overnight hours, according to Scott Rice, Director General of Massachusetts Emergency Assistance. The site is only open to families who have been assessed at a state intake site and determined to be eligible for emergency assistance. Rice said the facility will give eligible families a warm, safe place to sleep until a shelter unit becomes available. We encourage community organizations to reach out to us with any daytime programs and resources they are able to provide to families in need, Rice said in a statement. Now an opinion piece published on the 13th of December and written by David Saperstein, Anwart Khan, and Eugene Cho, published by Religion News Service, entitled, As Interfaith Leaders, We Are United to Protect Foreign Assistance. With the cascading crises the world is experiencing in 2023, it is surprising that our elected leaders are considering funding cuts to the U.S. foreign aid commitments. We are leaders from three different faith traditions, but we share a common belief in upholding humanity and human dignity. This is why we urge Congress to robustly fund international food assistance and humanitarian programs. It is common to hear claims that foreign aid must be reduced to deal with the deficit. However, we also know the great importance these programs have for our nation's security by helping to create resilience and stability in a challenging world. Members of the Interfaith Working Group on Foreign Assistance have met with key congressional leaders to educate them about the importance of maintaining international aid funding and programs, and the need for emergency supplemental humanitarian assistance to countries in crisis. Foreign aid and development funds make up less than 1% of federal spending. Cut every cent of foreign aid, and we've barely touched the deficit. Calling for the cutting of foreign humanitarian aid to deal with the deficit is not a serious proposal, but it will do serious harm. Ours is a nation built on ideals influenced by our faith communities. The U.S. first provided foreign aid all the way back in 1812 after a devastating earthquake in Venezuela. During World War I and World War II, the U.S. provided aid to civilians suffering the impact. And after World War II, we rebuilt Europe and Japan, possibly becoming the first victor in history to show such deep magnanimity. It's no coincidence that today the U.S. leads the world in providing emergency food and nutrition assistance, investing in development aid to help strengthen communities, and supporting health care and education. That is our calling. However, we are falling behind. China has substantially increased its foreign aid budget, and many of our allies invest a significantly higher percentage of their gross domestic product in foreign aid than we do, including Germany, Canada, Japan, the UK, France, and Australia. Today, many of our closest allies are nations that have received foreign aid, as are many of our leading trade partners. But more than the tangible benefits, America's aid to those in the greatest need nourishes the soul of our nation. At a time when so many foundational principles are under attack, we must retain our core character of generosity and compassion. American foreign humanitarian and development aid is among the most effectively managed spending the U.S. government engages in. Strict requirements are in place, programs are audited, and any agency or individual who violates the terms of aid is held accountable. Around the world, the U.S. enjoys the reputation of being the most exacting donor, and so it should be. Today, the number of displaced people has risen to 110 million, and as many as 783 million people are facing chronic hunger. 45 million children under age 5 suffer from wasting, meaning they are much too thin for their height. Approximately 1 million children each year die from it. This dramatic rise is due to conflicts, climate, and inflation. As a nation, we have a choice: remain true to our character and commitments and provide aid to people in crisis, or we can turn our backs. As faith leaders, we appeal to our leaders and our fellow citizens to follow God's calling to care for people in need. Lastly, a short piece from the U.S. News and World Report, published on December 20, entitled "White Supremacist Sentenced for Threatening Jury and Witnesses at Synagogue Shooter's Trial," Wheeling, West Virginia. A self-proclaimed white supremacist was sentenced to more than 6 years in federal prison for making online threats toward the jury and witnesses at the trial of a man who killed 11 congregants at a Pittsburgh synagogue. Hardy Carol Lloyd, 45, of Follansbee, West Virginia, was sentenced in federal court in northern West Virginia for his September guilty plea to obstruction of the due administration of justice. Lloyd admitted that the actual or perceived Jewish faith of the government witnesses and victims in the trial of Robert Bowers prompted him to target the jury and witnesses. The U.S. Justice Department described Lloyd as a self-proclaimed leader of a white supremacy movement. Prosecutors said Lloyd, who was arrested on August 10th, sent threatening social media posts and emails along with comments on websites during Bowers' trial. Bowers was sentenced to death in August in the deadliest attack on Jews in U.S. history after a jury determined that capital punishment was appropriate. In May 2022, the Texas Department of Public Safety offered a cash reward of up to $1,000 for information leading to Lloyd's arrest after he allegedly posted a series of comments online threatening to carry a firearm onto the Texas Capitol grounds and challenge any police officer who tried to take enforcement actions against him. A statement from the department said Lloyd was a convicted felon. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News, so be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.